Bright or not, the poor reader hasn't a chance. Let's say that we've recognized all that and agree to regard the IQ simply as a measure of some vaguely defined capacity to handle canned abstractions. And Peter and Linda have been given what is generally regarded as the best of the tests, the revised Stanford-Binet, which is administered individually and doesn't call for any particular reading ability. Now, what an IQ test purports to be is a sampling of the intellect. Like any other product of this sampling method, the IQ is a figure with a statistical error, which expresses the precision or reliability of that figure. Asking these test questions is something like what you might do in estimating the quality of the corn in a field by going about and pulling off an ear here and an ear there at random. By the time you had stripped down and looked at 100 ears, say, you would have gained a pretty good idea of what the whole field was like. Your information would be exact enough for use in comparing this field with another field, provided the two fields were not very similar. If they were, you might have to look at many more ears, rating them all the while by some precise standard of quality. How accurately your sample can be taken to represent the whole field is a measure that can be represented in figures, the probable error and the standard error. Suppose that you had the task of measuring the size of a good many fields by pacing off the fence lines. The first thing you might do is check the accuracy of your measuring system by pacing off what you took to be 100 yards, doing this a number of times. You might find that, on the average, you were off by 3 yards. That is, you came within 3 yards of hitting the exact 100 in half of your trials, and in the other half you missed them by more than 3 yards. Your probable error, then, would be 3 yards in 100, or 3%. From then on, each fence line that measured 100 yards by your pacing might be recorded as 100 plus or minus 3 yards. Most statisticians now prefer to use another but comparable measurement called the standard error. It takes in about 2/3 of cases instead of exactly half, and is considerably handier in a mathematical way. For our purposes, we can stick to the probable error, which is the one still used in connection with the Stanford-Binet. As with our hypothetical pacing, the probable error of the Stanford-Binet IQ has been found to be 3%. This has nothing to do with how good the test is, basically, only with how consistently it measures whatever it measures. So Peter's indicated IQ might be more fully expressed as 98 plus or minus 3, and Linda's as 101 plus or minus 3. This says that there is no more than an even chance that Peter's IQ falls anywhere between 95 and 101. It is just as likely that it is above or below that figure. Similarly, Linda's has no better than a 50-50 probability of being within the range of 98 to 104. From this, you can quickly see that there is one chance in four that Peter's IQ is really above 101, and a similar chance that Linda's is below 98. Then Peter is not inferior but superior, and by a margin of anywhere from 3 points up. What this comes down to is that the only way to think about IQs and many other sampling results is in ranges. Normal is not 100, but the range of 90 to 110, say, and there would be some point in comparing a child in this range with a child in a lower or higher range. But comparisons between figures with small differences are meaningless. You must always keep that plus or minus in mind, even, or especially, when it is not stated. Ignoring these errors, which are implicit in all sampling studies, has led to some remarkably silly behavior. There are magazine editors to whom readership surveys are gospel, mainly because they do not understand them. With 40% male readership reported for one article and only 35% for another, they demand more articles like the first. The difference between 35 and 40% readership can be of importance to a magazine, but a survey difference may not be a real one. Costs often hold readership samples down to a few hundred persons, particularly after those who do not read the magazine at all have been eliminated. For a magazine that appeals primarily to women, the number of men in the sample may be very small. By the time these have been divided among all those who say they read all, read most, read some, or didn't read the article in question, the 35% conclusion may be based on only a handful. The probable error hidden behind the impressively presented figure may be so large that the editor who relies on it is grasping at a thin straw. Sometimes, the big ado is made about a difference that is mathematically real and demonstrable, but so tiny as to have no importance. This is in defiance of the fine old saying that a difference is a difference only if it makes a difference. A case in point is the hullabaloo over practically nothing that was raised so effectively and so profitably by the old gold cigarette people. It started innocently with the editor of the Reader's Digest, who smokes cigarettes but takes a dim view of them all the same. His magazine went to work and had a battery of laboratory folk analyze the smoke from several brands of cigarettes. The magazine published the results, giving the nicotine and whatnot content of the smoke by brands. The conclusion stated by the magazine, and borne out in its detailed figures, was that all the brands were virtually identical and that it didn't make any difference which one you smoked. Now, you might think this was a blow to cigarette manufacturers and to the fellows who think up the new copy angles in the advertising agencies. It would seem to explode all advertising claims about soothing throats and kindness to T-zones. But somebody spotted something. In the lists of almost identical amounts of poisons, one cigarette had to be at the bottom, and the one was Old Gold. Out went the telegrams, and big advertisements appeared in newspapers at once in the biggest type at hand. The headlines and the copy simply said that of all cigarettes tested by this great national magazine, Old Gold had the least of these undesirable things in its smoke. Excluded were all figures and any hint that the difference was negligible. In the end, the Old Gold people were ordered to cease and desist from such misleading advertising. That didn't make any difference. The good had been milked from the idea long before. As the New Yorker says, there'll always be an ad man. Chapter 5. The Gee Whiz Graph. There is terror in numbers. Humpty Dumpty's confidence in telling Alice that he was master of the words he used would not be extended by many people to numbers. Perhaps we suffer from a trauma induced by grade school arithmetic. Whatever the cause, it creates a real problem for the writer who yearns to be read, the advertising man who expects his copy to sell goods, the publisher who wants his books or magazines to be popular. When numbers in tabular form are taboo, and words will not do the work well, as is often the case, there is only one answer left. Draw a picture. About the simplest kind of statistical picture, or graph, is the line variety. It is very useful for showing trends, something practically everybody is interested in showing or knowing, about spotting or deploring or forecasting. We'll let our graph show how national income increased 10% in a year. Begin with paper ruled into squares. Name the months along the bottom. Indicate billions of dollars up the side, from 0 to 24 billion. Now, draw a line showing a smooth linear increase from $20 billion to $22 billion over the year. Now, that's clear enough. It shows what happened during the year, and it shows it month by month. He who runs may see and understand, because the whole graph is in proportion, and there is a zero line at the bottom for comparison. Your 10% looks like 10%, an upward trend that is substantial, but perhaps not overwhelming. That's very well if all you want to do is convey information. But suppose you wish to win an argument, shock a reader, move him into action, sell him something. For that, this chart lacks schmaltz. Chop off the bottom so that instead of beginning at zero and running up to 24 billion, your chart now begins at 18 billion and goes up to 24 billion, a span of only $6 billion instead of 24. Now that's more like it. You've saved paper too. Something to point out if any carping fellow objects to your misleading graphics. The figures are the same, and so is the curve. It is the same graph. Nothing has been falsified, except the impression that it gives. But what the hasty reader sees now is a national income line that has climbed halfway up the paper in 12 months, all because most of the chart isn't there anymore. Like the missing parts of speech in sentences that you met in grammar classes, it is understood. Of course, the eye doesn't understand what isn't there, and a small rise has become, visually, a big one. Now that you have practiced to deceive, why stop with truncating? You have a further trick available that's worth a dozen of that. It will make your modest rise of 10% look livelier than 100% is entitled to look. Simply change the proportion between the ordinate, the vertical coordinate, and the abscissa, the horizontal coordinate. There's no rule against it, and it does give your graph a prettier shape. All you have to do is let each mark up the side stand for only 1/10 as many dollars as before. That is impressive, isn't it? Anyone looking at it can just feel prosperity throbbing in the arteries of the country. It is a subtler equivalent of editing national income rose 10% into climbed a whopping 10%. It is vastly more effective, however, because it contains no adjectives or adverbs to spoil the illusion of objectivity. There's nothing anyone can pin on you. And you're in good, or at least respectable, company. Newsweek magazine used this method to show that stocks hit a 21-year high in 1951, truncating the graph at the 80 mark. A Columbia Gas System advertisement in Time in 1952 reproduced a chart from our new annual report. If you read the little numbers and analyzed them, you found that during a 10-year period, living costs went up about 60% and the cost of gas dropped 4%. This is a favorable picture, but it apparently was not favorable enough for Columbia Gas. They chopped off their chart at 90% with no gap or other indication to warn you, so that this was what your eye told you. Living costs have more than tripled and gas has gone down 1/3. Steel companies have used similarly misleading graphic methods in attempts to line up public opinion against wage increases. Yet the method is far from new, and its impropriety was shown up long ago, not just in technical publications for statisticians either. An editorial writer in Dunn's Review in 1938 reproduced a chart from an advertisement advocating advertising in Washington, D.C., the argument being nicely expressed in the headline over the chart. Government payrolls up. The line in the graph went along with the exclamation point, even though the figures behind it did not. What they showed was an increase from about $19,500 to $20,000. But the red line shot from near the bottom of the graph clear up to the top, making an increase of under 4% look like more than 400. The magazine gave its own graphic version of the same figures alongside, an honest red line that rose just 4% under this caption. Government payrolls stable. Chapter 6. The One-Dimensional Picture. A decade or so ago, you heard a good deal about the little people, meaning practically all of us. When this began to sound too condescending, we became the common man. Pretty soon that was forgotten too, which was probably just as well. But the little man is still with us. He is the character on the chart. A chart on which a little man represents a million men, a money bag or a stack of coins, $1,000 or $1 billion, or an outline of a steer, your beef supply for next year, is a pictorial graph. It is a useful device. It has what I am afraid is known as eye appeal, and it is capable of becoming a fluent, devious, and successful liar. The daddy of the pictorial chart, or pictograph, is the ordinary bar chart, a simple and popular method of representing quantities when two or more are to be compared. A bar chart is capable of deceit, too. Look with suspicion on any version in which the bars change their widths as well as their lengths while representing a single factor, or in which they picture three-dimensional objects, the volumes of which are not easy to compare. A truncated bar chart has, and deserves, exactly the same reputation as the truncated line graph we've been talking about. The habitat of the bar chart is the geography book, the corporation statement, and the news magazine. This is true also of its eye-appealing offspring. Perhaps I wish to show a comparison of two figures, the average weekly wage of carpenters in the United States and Rotundia, let's say. The sums might be $60 and $30. I wish to catch your eye with this, so I'm not satisfied merely to print the numbers. I make a bar chart. By the way, if that $60 figure doesn't square with the huge sum you laid out when your porch needed a new railing last summer, remember that your carpenter may not have done as well every week as he did while working for you. And anyway, I didn't say what kind of average I have in mind or how I arrived at it, so it isn't going to get you anywhere to quibble. You see how easy it is to hide behind the most disreputable statistic if you don't include any other information with it? You probably guessed I just made this one up for purposes of illustration, but I'll bet you wouldn't have if I'd used $59.83 instead. So, imagine a chart with dollars per week indicated up the left side, and our countries listed across the bottom. The bar representing Rotundia's $30 per week average reaches halfway up the chart, and the bar for the United States' $60 weekly is exactly twice that high. It's a clear and honest picture. Twice as much money is twice as big on the chart, and looks it. The chart lacks that eye appeal, though, doesn't it? I can easily supply that by using something that looks more like money than a bar does. Money bags. One money bag for the unfortunate Rotundian's pittance, two for the American's wage, or three for the Rotundian, six for the American. Either way, the chart remains honest and clear, and it will not deceive your hasty glance. That is the way an honest pictograph is made. That would satisfy me if all I wanted was to communicate information. But I want more. I want to say that the American working man is vastly better off than the Rotundian, and the more I can dramatize the difference between 30 and 60, the better it will be for my argument. To tell the truth, which is, of course, what I'm planning not to do, I want you to infer something, to come away with an exaggerated impression, but I don't want to be caught at my tricks. There is a way, and it is one that is being used every day, to fool you. I simply draw a money bag to represent the Rotundian's $30, and then I draw another one, twice as tall, to represent the American's $60. That's in proportion, isn't it? Now that gives the impression I'm after. The American's wage now dwarfs the foreigner's. The catch, of course, is this. Because the second bag is twice as high as the first, it is also twice as wide. It occupies not twice, but four times as much area on the page. The numbers still say 2-1, but the visual impression, which is the dominating one most of the time, says the ratio is 4-1, or worse. Since these pictures are of objects having, in reality, three dimensions, the second must also be twice as thick as the first. As your geometry book puts it, the volumes of similar solids vary as the cube of any like dimension. 2 × 2 × 2 = 8. If one money bag holds $30, the other, having 8 times the volume, must hold not $60, but $240. And that, indeed, is the impression my ingenious little chart gives. While saying twice, I have left the lasting impression of an overwhelming 8-1 ratio. You'll have trouble pinning any criminal intent on me, too. I'm only doing what a great many other people do. Newsweek magazine has done it, with money bags at that. The American Iron and Steel Institute has done it with a pair of blast furnaces. The idea was to show how the industry's steel-making capacity had boomed between the 1930s and the 1940s, and so indicate that the industry was doing such a job on its own hook that any governmental interference was uncalled for. there is more merit in the principle than in the way it was presented. The blast furnace representing the 10 million ton capacity added in the 1930s was drawn to just over two-thirds as tall as the one for the 14 and a quarter million tons added in the 40s. The eye saw two furnaces, one of them close to three times as big as the other. To say one and a half and be heard as three, that's what the one-dimensional picture can accomplish. Some of this may be no more than sloppy draftsmanship, but it is rather like being short-changed. When all the mistakes are in the cashier's favor, you can't help wondering. Newsweek once showed how U.S. old folks grow older by means of a chart on which appeared two male figures, one representing the 68.2-year life expectancy of today, the other the 34-year life expectancy of 1879 to 1889. It was the same old story. One figure was twice as tall as the other and so would have had eight times the bulk or weight. This picture sensationalized facts in order to make a better story. I would call it a form of yellow journalism. The same issue of the magazine contained a truncated or gee whiz line graph. There is still another kind of danger in varying the size of objects in a chart. It seems that in 1860, there were something over 8 million milk cows in the United States, and by 1936, there were more than 25 million. Showing this increase by drawing two cows, one three times the height of the other, will exaggerate the impression in the manner we've been discussing. But the effect on the hasty scanner of the page may be even stranger. He may easily come away with the idea that cows are bigger now than they used to be. Chapter 7. The Semi-Attached Figure. If you can't prove what you want to prove, demonstrate something else, and pretend that they are the same thing. In the days that follows the collision of statistics with the human mind, hardly anybody will notice the difference. The semi-attached figure is a device guaranteed to stand you in good stead. It always has. You can't prove that your nostrum cures colds, but you can publish, in large type, a sworn laboratory report that half an ounce of the stuff killed 31,108 germs in a test tube in 11 seconds. While you're about it, make sure that the laboratory is reputable or has an impressive name. Reproduce the report in full. Photograph a doctor-type model in white clothes and put his picture alongside. But don't mention the several gimmicks in your story. It's not up to you, is it, to point out that an antiseptic that works well in a test tube may not perform in the human throat, especially after it's been diluted according to instructions to keep it from burning throat tissue. Don't confuse the issue by telling what kind of germ you killed. Who knows what germ causes colds, particularly since it probably isn't a germ at all. In fact, there is no known connection between assorted germs in a test tube and whatever it is that produces colds. But people aren't going to reason that sharply, especially while sniffling. Maybe that one's too obvious and people are beginning to catch on, although it would not appear so from the advertising pages. Anyway, here's a trickier version. Let us say that during a period in which race prejudice is growing, you are employed to prove otherwise. It's not a difficult assignment. Set up a poll, or, better yet, have the polling done for you by an organization of good reputation. Ask that usual cross-section of the population if they think blacks have as good a chance as white people to get jobs. Repeat your polling at intervals so that you'll have a trend to report. Princeton's Office of Public Opinion Research tested this question once. What turned up is interesting evidence that things, especially in opinion polls, are not always what they seem. Each person who was asked the question about jobs was also asked some questions designed to discover if he was strongly prejudiced against blacks. It turned out that people most strongly prejudiced were most likely to answer yes to the question about job opportunities. It worked out that about two-thirds of those who were sympathetic towards blacks did not think the black had as good a chance at a job as a white person did, and about two-thirds of those showing prejudice said that blacks were getting as good breaks as whites. It was pretty evident that from this poll, you would learn very little about employment conditions for blacks, although you might learn some interesting things about a man's racial attitudes. You can see, then, that if prejudice is mounting during your polling period, you will get an increasing number of answers to the effect that blacks have as good a chance at jobs as whites. So you announce your results. Your poll shows that blacks are getting a fairer shake all the time. You have achieved something remarkable by careful use of a semi-attached figure. The worse things get, the better your poll makes them look. Or take this one. Quote, 27% of a large sample of eminent physicians smoke throaties, more than any other brand. The figure itself may be phony, of course, in any of several ways, but that really doesn't make any difference. The only answer to a figure so irrelevant is, so what? With all proper respect toward the medical profession, do doctors know any more about tobacco brands than you do? Do they have any inside information that permits them to choose the least harmful among cigarettes? Of course they don't, and your doctor would be the first to say so. Yet, that 27% somehow manages to sound as if it meant something. Now, slip back 1% and consider the case of the juice extractor. It was widely advertised as a device that extracts 26% more juice, as proved by a laboratory test, and vouched for by Good Housekeeping Institute. That sounds right good. If you can buy a juicer that's 26% more effective, why buy any other kind? Well now, without going into the fact that laboratory tests, especially independent laboratory tests, have proved some of the darndest things, just what does that figure mean? 26% more than what? When it was finally pinned down, it was found to mean only that this juicer got out that much more juice than an old-fashioned hand reamer could. It had absolutely nothing to do with the data you would want before purchasing. This juicer might be the poorest on the market. Besides being suspiciously precise, that 26% figure is totally irrelevant. Advertisers aren't the only people who will fool you with numbers if you let them. An article on driving safety, published by This Week magazine, undoubtedly with your best interests at heart, told you what might happen to you if you went, quote, hurtling down the highway at 70 miles an hour, careening from side to side. You would have, the article said, 4 times as good a chance of staying alive if the time were 7 in the morning than if it were 7 at night. The evidence. 4 times more fatalities occur on the highways at 7 p.m. than at 7 a.m. Now, that is approximately true, but the conclusion doesn't follow. More people are killed in the evening than in the morning simply because more people are on the highways then to be killed. You, a single driver, may be in greater danger in the evening, but there is nothing in the figures to prove it either way. By the same kind of nonsense that the article writer used, you can show that clear weather is more dangerous than foggy weather. More accidents occur in clear weather because there is more clear weather than foggy weather. All the same, fog may be much more dangerous to drive in. You can use accident statistics to scare yourself to death in connection with any kind of transportation, if you fail to note how poorly attached the figures are. More people were killed by airplanes last year than in 1910. Therefore, modern planes are more dangerous? Nonsense. There are hundreds of times more people flying now. That's all. It was reported that the number of deaths chargeable to steam railroads in one recent year was 4,712. That sounds like a good argument for staying off trains. Perhaps for sticking to your automobile instead. But when you investigate to find what the figure is all about, you learn it means something quite different. Nearly half those victims were people whose automobiles collided with trains at crossings. The greater part of the rest were riding the rods. Only 132 out of the 4,712 were passengers on trains. and even that figure is worth little for purposes of comparison, unless it is attached to information on total passenger miles. If you're worried about your chances of being killed on a coast-to-coast trip, you won't get much relevant information by asking whether trains, planes, or cars killed the greatest number of people last year. Get the rate by inquiring into the number of fatalities for each million passenger miles. That will come closest to telling you where your greatest risk lies. There are many other forms of counting up something and then reporting it as something else. The general method is to pick two things that sound the same, but are not. As personnel manager for a company that is scrapping with a union, you make a survey of employees to find out how many have a complaint against the union. Unless the union is a band of angels with an archangel at their head, you can ask and record with perfect honesty and come out with proof that the greater part of the men do have some complaint or other. You issue your information as a report that a vast majority, 78%, are opposed to the union. What you have done is to add up a bunch of undifferentiated complaints and tiny gripes, and then call them something else that sounds like the same thing. You haven't proved a thing, but it rather sounds as if you have, doesn't it? It is fair enough, though, in a way. The union can just as readily prove that practically all the workers object to the way the plant is being run. If you'd like to go on a hunt for semi-attached figures, you might try running through corporation financial statements. Watch for profits that might look too big and so are concealed under another name. The United Automobile Workers magazine, Ammunition, describes the device this way. The statement says, last year the company made $35 million in profits. Just 1.5 cents out of every sales dollar. You feel sorry for the company. A bulb burns out in the latrine. To replace it, the company has to spend 30 cents. Just like that, there's the profit on 20 sales dollars. Makes a man want to go easy on the paper towels. But, of course, the truth is, what the company reports as profits is only a half or a third of the profits. The part that isn't reported is hidden in depreciation and special depreciation, and in reserves for contingencies. Equally gay fun is to be had with percentages. For a recent 9-month period, General Motors was able to report a relatively modest profit, after taxes, of 12.6% on sales. But for that same period, GM's profit on its investment came to 44.8%, which sounds a good deal worse, or better, depending on what kind of argument you're trying to win. Similarly, a reader of Harper's Magazine came to the defense of the A&P stores in that magazine's letters column by pointing to low net earnings of only 1.1% on sales. He asked, would any American citizen fear public condemnation as a profiteer for realizing a little over $10 for every $1,000 invested during a year? Offhand, this 1.1% sounds almost distressingly small. Compare it with the 4-6% or more interest that most of us are familiar with from FHA mortgages and bank loans and such. Wouldn't the A&P be better off if it went out of the grocery business and put its capital into the bank and lived off the interest? The catch is that annual return on investment is not the same kettle of fish as earnings on total sales. As another reader replied in a later issue of Harper's, if I purchase an article every morning for 99 cents and sell it each afternoon for $1, I will make only 1% on total sales, but 365% on invested money during the year. There are often many ways of expressing any figure. You can, for instance, express exactly the same fact by calling it a 1% return on sales, a 15% return on investment, a $10 million profit, an increase in profits of 40% compared with 1935 to 39 average, or a decrease of 60% from last year. The method is to choose the one that sounds best for the purpose at hand and trust that few who read it will recognize how imperfectly it reflects the situation. Not all semi-attached figures are products of intentional deception. Many statistics, including medical ones that are pretty important to everybody, are distorted by inconsistent reporting at the source. There are startlingly contradictory figures on such delicate matters as abortions, illegitimate births, and syphilis. If you should look up the latest available figures on influenza and pneumonia, you might come to the strange conclusion that these ailments are practically confined to three southern states, which account for about 80% of the reported cases. What actually explains this percentage is the fact that these three states required reporting of the ailments after the other states had stopped doing so. Some malaria figures mean as little. Where before 1940 there were hundreds of thousands of cases a year in the American South, there are now only a handful. A salubrious and apparently important change that took place in just a few years. But all that has happened in actuality is that cases are now recorded only when proved to be malaria, where formerly the word was used in much of the South as a colloquialism for a cold or chill. The death rate in the Navy during the Spanish-American War was 9 per thousand. For civilians in New York City during the same period, it was 16 per thousand. Navy recruiters later used these figures to show that it was safer to be in the Navy than out of it. Assume these figures to be accurate, as they probably are. Stop for a moment and see if you can spot what makes them, or at least the conclusion the recruiting people drew from them, virtually meaningless. The groups are not comparable. The Navy is made up mainly of young men in known good health. A civilian population includes infants, the old, and the ill, all of whom have a higher death rate wherever they are. These figures do not at all prove that men meeting Navy standards will live longer in the Navy than out. They do not prove the contrary either. You may have heard the discouraging news that 1952 was the worst polio year in medical history. This conclusion was based on what might seem all the evidence anyone could ask for. There were far more cases reported in that year than ever before. But when experts went back on these figures, they found a few things that were more encouraging. One was that there were so many children at the most susceptible ages in 1952 that cases were bound to be at a record number if the rate remained level. Another was that a general consciousness of polio was leading to more frequent diagnosis and recording of mild cases. Finally, there was an increased financial incentive, there being more polio insurance and more aid available from the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. All this threw considerable doubt on the notion that polio had reached a new high, and the total number of deaths confirmed the doubt. It's an interesting fact that the death rate, or number of deaths, often is a better measure of the incidence of an ailment than direct incidence figures, simply because the quality of reporting and record-keeping is so much higher on fatalities. In this instance, the obviously semi-attached figure is better than the one that, on the face of it, seems fully attached. In America, the semi-attached figure enjoys a big boom every fourth year. This indicates not that the figure is cyclical in nature, but only that campaign time has arrived. A campaign statement issued by the Republican Party in October of 1948 is built entirely on figures that appear to be attached to each other, but are not. When Dewey was elected governor in 1942, the minimum teacher's salary in some districts was as low as $900 a year. Today, the school teachers in New York State enjoy the highest salaries in the world. Upon Governor Dewey's recommendation, based on the findings of a committee he appointed, the legislature in 1947 appropriated $32 million out of a state surplus to provide an immediate increase in the salaries of school teachers. As a result, the minimum salaries of teachers in New York City range from $2,500 to $5,325. It is entirely possible that Mr. Dewey has proved himself the teacher's friend, but these figures don't show it. It is the old before and after trick, with a number of unmentioned factors introduced and made to appear what they are not. Here you have a before of $900 and an after of $2,500 to $5,325, which sounds like an improvement indeed. But the small figure is the lowest salary in any rural district of the state, and the big one is the range in New York City alone. There may have been an improvement under Governor Dewey, and there may not. This statement illustrates a statistical form of the before and after photograph that is a familiar stunt in magazines and advertising. A living room is photographed twice to show you what a vast improvement a coat of paint can make. But between the two exposures, new furniture has been added, and sometimes the before picture is a tiny one in poorly lighted black and white, and the after version is a big photograph in full color. Or, a pair of pictures shows you what happened when a girl began to use a hair rinse. By golly, she does look better afterwards at that. But most of the change, you note on careful inspection, has been wrought by persuading her to smile and throwing a backlight on her hair. More credit belongs to the photographer than to the rinse. Chapter 8. Post Hoc Rides Again. Somebody once went to a good deal of trouble to find out if cigarette smokers make lower college grades than non-smokers. It turned out that they did. This pleased a good many people, and they have been making much of it ever since. The road to good grades, it would appear, lies in giving up smoking. And, to carry the conclusion one reasonable step further, smoking makes dull minds. This particular study was, I believe, properly done. Sample big enough and honestly and carefully chosen. Correlation having a high significance, and so on. The fallacy is an ancient one that, however, has a powerful tendency to crop up in statistical material, where it is disguised by a welter of impressive figures. It is the one that says that if B follows A, then A has caused B. An unwarranted assumption is being made that since smoking and low grades go together, smoking causes low grades. Couldn't it just as well be the other way around? Perhaps low marks drive students not to drink, but to tobacco. When it comes right down to it, this conclusion is about as likely as the other, and just as well supported by the evidence. But it is not nearly so satisfactory to propagandists. It seems a good deal more probable, however, that neither of these things has produced the other, but both are a product of some third factor. Can it be that the sociable sort of fellow who takes his books less than seriously is also likely to smoke more? Or is there a clue in the fact that somebody once established a correlation between extroversion and low grades? A closer relationship, apparently, than the one between grades and intelligence. Maybe extroverts smoke more than introverts. The point is that when there are many reasonable explanations, you are hardly entitled to pick one that suits your taste and insist on it. But many people do. To avoid falling for the post hoc fallacy, and thus wind up believing many things that are not so, you need to put any statement of relationship through a sharp inspection. The correlation, that convincingly precise figure that seems to prove that something is because of something, can actually be any of several types. One is the correlation produced by chance. You may be able to get together a set of figures to prove some unlikely thing in this way, but if you try again, your next set may not prove it at all. As with the manufacturer of the toothpaste that appeared to reduce decay, you simply throw away the results you don't want and publish widely those you do. Given a small sample, you are likely to find some substantial correlation between any pair of characteristics or events that you can think of. A common kind of covariation is one in which the relationship is real, but it's not possible to be sure which of the variables is the cause and which the effect. In some of these instances, cause and effect may change places from time to time, or indeed, both may be cause and effect at the same time. A correlation between income and ownership of stocks might be of that kind. The more money you make, the more stock you buy. And the more stock you buy, the more income you get. It's not accurate to say simply that one has produced the other. Perhaps the trickiest of them all is the very common instance in which neither of the variables has any effect at all on the other, yet there is a real correlation. A good deal of dirty work has been done with this one. The poor grades among cigarette smokers is in this category, as are all too many medical statistics that are quoted without the qualification that, although the relationship has been shown to be real, the cause and effect nature of it is only a matter of speculation. As an instance of the nonsense or spurious correlation that is a real statistical fact, someone has gleefully pointed to this. There is a close relationship between the salaries of Presbyterian ministers in Massachusetts and the price of rum in Havana. Which is the cause and which is the effect? In other words, are the ministers benefiting from the rum trade or supporting it? All right. That's so far-fetched that it's ridiculous at a glance. But watch out for other applications of post-hoc logic that differ from this one only in being more subtle. In the case of the ministers and the rum, it's easy to see that both figures are growing because of the influence of a third factor, the historic and worldwide rise in the price level of practically everything. And take the figures that show the suicide rate to be at its maximum in June. Do suicides produce June brides? Or do June weddings precipitate suicides of the jilted? A somewhat more convincing, though equally unproved, explanation is that the fellow who licks his depression all through the winter with the thought that things will look rosier in the spring gives up when June comes and he still feels terrible. Another thing to watch out for is a conclusion in which a correlation has been inferred to continue beyond the data with which it has been demonstrated. It's easy to show that the more it rains in an area, the taller the corn grows, or even the greater the crop. Rain, it seems, is a blessing. But a season of very heavy rainfall may damage or even ruin the crop. The positive correlation holds up to a point, and then quickly becomes a negative one. Above so many inches, the more it rains, the less corn you get. We're going to pay a little attention to the evidence on the money value of education in a minute. But for now, let's assume it has been proved that high school graduates make more money than those who drop out, and that each year of undergraduate work in college adds some more income. Watch out for the general conclusion that the more you go to school, the more money you'll make. Note that this has not been shown to be true for the years beyond an undergraduate degree, and it may very well not apply to them either. People with PhDs quite often become college teachers, and so do not become members of the highest income groups. A correlation, of course, shows a tendency that is not often the ideal relationship, described as one-to-one. Tall boys weigh more than short boys on the average, so this is a positive correlation. But you can easily find a six-footer who weighs less than some five-footers, so the correlation is less than one. A negative correlation is simply a statement that as one variable increases, the other tends to decrease. In physics, this becomes an inverse ratio. The farther you get from a light bulb, the less light there is on your book. As distance increases, light intensity decreases. These physical relationships often have the kindness to produce perfect correlations, but figures from business or sociology or medicine seldom work out so neatly. Even if education generally increases incomes, it may easily turn out to be the financial ruination of Joe over there. Keep in mind that a correlation may be real and based on real cause and effect, and still be almost worthless in determining action in any single case. Reams of pages of figures have been collected to show the value in dollars of a college education, and stacks of pamphlets have been published to bring these figures, and conclusions more or less based on them, to the attention of potential students. I'm not quarreling with the intention. I'm in favor of education myself, particularly if it includes a course in elementary statistics. Now, these figures have pretty conclusively demonstrated that people who have gone to college make more money than people who haven't. The exceptions are numerous, of course, but the tendency is strong and clear. The only thing wrong is that, along with the figures and facts, goes a totally unwarranted conclusion. This is the post hoc fallacy at its best. It says that these figures show that if you, your son, your daughter, attend college, you will probably earn more money than if you decide to spend the next 4 years in some other manner. This unwarranted conclusion has for its basis the equally unwarranted assumption that since college-trained folks make more money, they make it because they went to college. Actually, we don't know but that these are the people who would have made more money even if they hadn't gone to college. There are a couple of things that indicate rather strongly that this is so. Colleges get a disproportionate number of two groups of kids, the bright and the rich. The bright might show good earning power without college knowledge. And as for the rich ones, well, money breeds money in several obvious ways. Few sons of rich men are found in low income brackets, whether they go to college or not. The following passage is taken from an article in question and answer form that appeared in This Week magazine, a Sunday supplement of enormous circulation. Maybe you'll find it amusing, as I do, that the same writer once produced a piece called Popular Notions, True or False? Question. What effect does going to college have on your chances of remaining unmarried? Answer. If you're a woman, it skyrockets your chances of becoming an old maid. But if you're a man, it has the opposite effect. It minimizes your chances of staying a bachelor. Cornell University made a study of 1,500 typical middle-aged college graduates. Of the men, 93% were married, compared to 83% for the general population. But of the middle-aged women graduates, only 65% were married. Spinsters were relatively three times as numerous among college graduates as among women of the general population. When Susie Brown, age 17, reads this, she learns that if she goes to college, she will be less likely to get a man than if she doesn't. That is what the article says, and there are statistics from a reputable source to go with it. They go with it, but they don't back it up. And note also that while the statistics are Cornell's, the conclusions are not, although a hasty reader may come away with the idea that they are. Here again, a real correlation has been used to bolster up an unproved cause and effect relationship. Perhaps it all works the other way around, and those women would have remained unmarried even if they hadn't gone to college. Possibly even more would have failed to marry. If these possibilities are no better than the one the writer insists upon, they are perhaps just as valid conclusions. That is, guesses. Indeed, there is one piece of evidence suggesting that a propensity for old maidhood may lead to going to college. Dr. Kinsey seems to have found some correlation between sexuality and education, with traits perhaps being fixed at pre-college age. That makes it all the more questionable to say that going to college gets in the way of marrying. Note to Susie Brown. It ain't necessarily so. A medical article once pointed with great alarm to an increase in cancer among milk drinkers. Cancer, it seems, was becoming increasingly frequent in New England, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Switzerland, where a lot of milk is produced and consumed, while remaining rare in Ceylon, where milk is scarce. For further evidence, it was pointed out that cancer was less frequent in some southern states where less milk was consumed. Also, it pointed out, milk-drinking English women get some kinds of cancer 18 times as frequently as Japanese women, who seldom drink milk. A little digging might uncover quite a number of ways to account for these figures, but one factor is enough by itself to show them up. Cancer is predominantly a disease that strikes in middle life or after. Switzerland and the states mentioned first are alike in having populations with relatively long spans of life. English women at the time the study was made were living an average of 12 years longer than Japanese women. Professor Helen M. Walker has worked out an amusing illustration of the folly in assuming there must be cause and effect whenever two things vary together. In investigating the relationship between age and some physical characteristics of women, begin by measuring the angle of the feet in walking. You will find that the angle tends to be greater among older women. You might first consider whether this indicates that women grow older because they toe out. And you can see immediately that this is ridiculous. So it appears that age increases the angle between the feet, and most women must come to toe out more as they grow older. Any such conclusion is probably false and certainly unwarranted. You could only reach it legitimately by studying the same women, or possibly equivalent groups, over a period of time. That would eliminate the factor responsible here, which is that the older women grew up at a time when a young lady was taught to toe out in walking, while the members of the younger group were learning posture in a day when that was discouraged. When you find somebody, usually an interested party, making a fuss about a correlation, look first of all to see if it is not one of this type, produced by the stream of events, the trend of the times. In our time, it is easy to show a positive correlation between any pair of things like these. Number of students in college, number of inmates in mental institutions, consumption of cigarettes, incidence of heart disease, use of X-ray machines, production of false teeth, salaries of California school teachers, profits of Nevada gambling halls. To call some one of these the cause of some other is manifestly silly, but it is done every day. Permitting statistical treatment and the hypnotic presence of numbers and decimal points to befog causal relationships is little better than superstition, and it is often more seriously misleading. It is rather like the conviction among the people of the New Hebrides that body lice produce good health. Observation over the centuries had taught them that people in good health usually had lice, and sick people very often did not. The observation itself was accurate and sound, as observations made informally over the years surprisingly often are. Not so much can be said for the conclusion to which these primitive people came from their evidence. Lice make a man healthy. Everybody should have them. As we have already noted, scantier evidence than this, treated in the statistical mill until common sense could no longer penetrate to it, has made many a medical fortune and many a medical article in magazines, including professional ones. More sophisticated observers finally got things straightened out in the New Hebrides. As it turned out, almost everybody in those circles had lice most of the time. It was, you might say, the normal condition of man. When, however, anyone took a fever, quite possibly carried to him by those same lice, and his body became too hot for comfortable habitation, the lice left. There you have cause and effect, altogether confusingly distorted, reversed, and intermingled. Chapter 9. How to Statisticulate. Misinforming people by the use of statistical material might be called statistical manipulation. In a word, though not a very good one,